Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest news from Libya and speak with Ali Abdallatif Hamida, Chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England and author of The Making of Modern Libya. We will discuss the end game of the revolution that has toppled 42 years of dictatorship, leaving many questions unanswered about what will fill the political vacuum in Libya. Then we will look further into Libya's uncertain future and what Libya might look like in 10 years. Daniel Serwa, a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a scholar at the Middle East Institute, joins us. He worked on post-war stability in the Balkans, and we will discuss the possibility of human rights abuses and retribution, as well as who exactly are Libya's National Transition Council and who do they represent. Then finally, Ambassador Mark Ginsburg joins us. He is a former presidential advisor and U.S. ambassador to Morocco, and we'll look into the broader shifting landscape in the Middle East and how the fall of another dictator to the Arab Spring will impact Syria and its neighbors. Joining us now is Ali Abdallatif Hamida, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He's the author of The Making of Modern Libya, Forgotten Voices, Power and Agency in Colonial and Postcolonial Libya, and Post-Orientalism, Critical Reviews in North African Social and Cultural History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Professor Ali Abdallatif Hamida.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me again.
And it's good to catch up with you again, and particularly on this day, which is, I guess, pretty much the end of this 42-year-old dictatorship. Today, the rebels took the compound. I saw an amusing video of a Berber warrior wearing Gaddafi's hat with all of its gold scrambled eggs on it and wearing a huge gold chain and this big kind of mace that he was carrying. But, of course, they don't have the dictator yet. They've got his clothes.
Yes, it's been a while since we spoke last time. And I think, if I recall, I said then that Gaddafi and his regime lost the moral battle. Since then, they lost international support. And now we're witnessing they are losing the military battle.
Well, that's notwithstanding that the son appeared out of nowhere. He was supposed to have been captured, according to the rebels, and then he shows up. And it was quite surreal what he was saying to the press there that are holed up in the Riox Hotel, which is surrounded by Gaddafi loyalists. Saif al-Islam was telling the reporters, let's go out to the neighborhood, the safest neighborhood where you get the best nightclubs and it's really the hot spots. I mean, I thought that I was actually watching somebody who was completely deranged. I mean, we always thought that the father was off the wall, but the son seems to be equally delusional.
Yes, yes, indeed. And I think it was not only he was turned to be a big disappointment, and he turned to be somebody who's like his father, since the uprising began. But also, this whole thing was a ruse, a deflection cooked by Saif al-Islam in a theatrical, kind of almost like a movie-like, calling the council and also to the media, say, he was arrested by somebody, his aide, we know now, and then trying to use that as a ploy to say, hey, I'm free, and we know that they had no access to international media. So I think what we discovered today is that it was a ploy by Saif al-Islam, and unfortunately, theatrical, almost kind of surreal speech that he gave today was just laughable because the regime is completely bankrupt, except the fact, of course, Libyan South is still controlled by the Gaddafi brigades. That's, we're talking about Central Libya and Southern Libya, where people are being basically really terrorized by these brigades.
So, in other words, once the capital settles down and we find out a little bit more about this government and its ability to hold the factions together, because, what seems to be apparent now is that it was largely the Westerners who won the military victory, and the Easterners have been the ones that have been getting all the support from the international community, and they don't seem to have gotten very far. And I'm wondering whether that's a potential fault line in the future. But what you're telling us here, Professor Ali Abdallatif Hamida, is that the South is largely in Gaddafi's control, and that's a big chunk of territory, isn't it?
It is. And I think because we know that in Sirte, for example, this is his home city where he was born near that city. And also in Sabha, he had his own tribe who are armed to the teeth. side, two or three major security brigades that are still intact in these two regions. So it's not over, but I think the liberation of Tripoli is tremendous symbolic victory for the revolution. And today, the attack against the Bab al-Aziziyya compound, Gaddafi's headquarters, is tremendous boost to the revolution. So we're talking about the city that has 2 million people, really the heart of Libya. And I was praying that the city will not be destroyed or burned like Baghdad or other places. And the rebels and the revolutionaries showed tremendous ability to coordinate with each other, and their plan was very impressive, I should say.
So you're not worried then about fissures between the Western rebels, who seem to be much more militarily effective than the Eastern rebels?
Oh, I am worried, Ian. I think the big battle now is just facing us. I think getting rid of the Gaddafi regime was very, very tough. But the challenge is now for the leaders of the uprising is to work together to make sure that property and institutions and functions of society is not destroyed, and also not factionalism. Now the common enemy is being defeated. I'm very, very concerned, and I think one way to I'm concerned about is I want to see tremendous awareness of the challenges ahead, because Libya could be a model for the region. Even though its infrastructure and cities were destroyed, thousands of people being killed and injured and maimed and so. But at the same time, unless there is awareness and there is maturity and vision to not to take revenge, not to take vendetta with all the horrors that happen in the country, if there is no awareness, I think, yes, there is also the potential for factions and infighting, and God forbid, an Iraqi or Somali or Afghani example being repeated in Libya. I'm not sure, though. So far, I think the leadership has been very, very coordinated, had only one crisis, the assassination of General Yunus. But other than that, I think so far so good, and the liberation of Tripoli, as I said, has been impressive. But it doesn't mean the challenges ahead for the Libyan revolution is going to be easy. Actually, the challenge will be tremendous. And as you said, coordinating between the leadership in the West and the East, making sure that there will be no looting, making sure that people who lost good, beloved ones, and make sure that the bitterness and the natural human tendency to really react is put in a larger context where the country could heal its wounds.
Again, I'm speaking with Professor Ali Abdellatif Hamida, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England and author of The Making of Modern Libya. You mentioned earlier that you have information that the whole piece of theater with Saif al-Islam, the idea that he was captured by the rebels, was actually invented by him and his own people, and they staged that as a way to get media attention, as a propaganda move to make it look like they're still a formidable force, that they're still something to be reckoned with. I was speaking yesterday to a former CIA officer who seems to have very good connections, just on the matter of General Yunus that you mentioned, who was assassinated. I was told yesterday that that was actually done by his own tribe. It wasn't the Islamists. Do you have any information on that?
It's still very, very unclear to us what are really the facts about what happened then. And even the council in Benghazi that's leading the uprising wasn't very clear. So I think we're going to know more about it later on. There are conflicting narrative about that, and I'm not sure this is really resolved yet. Let me just add one. There are two threats to the uprising, Ian. There is a threat from not only the challenges and the problems of destroyed, as a country now. Let's hope that the allies, the NATO countries, and our own government in the United States will resist the temptation to impose its own agenda after helping the Libyan uprising. I think that's very crucial, because that will mean we'll go back to the monarchy and radicalization of new generation of young Libyans. It's very, very important, despite the blood and the suffering. It was a battle that Libyan society, in my opinion, had to fight and resolve it. And even though it took longer, but I think Libya has the potential to really create a more stable democratic republic.
Well, it's very interesting and to see some of the political reactions to what's happening in Libya, in the West, and here in the United States. It seems that on the left, and of course the left in this country is not particularly strong or influential, but I think one of the things that's happening is that they're discrediting themselves by appearing not to be very happy about the fact that the Libyan people have liberated themselves and the terrible tyrant, a murderous thief who's exploited this country mercilessly for 42 years is all but finished. And one of the things that strikes me about the irony about this is that from Hugo Chavez in Venezuela to people like Denis Kucinich over here, they focus only on NATO bombing, not on the extent to which the Libyan people, almost all of them, as far as I can tell, except for the people on Gaddafi's payroll, rose up initially. And then they had no arms, and then he threatened to slaughter them all. And then they painfully fought their way back. Obviously, they've been supplied by the West. And you're quite right to suggest that if the West tries to cash in on this victory, it would be a complete disaster. I think it would backfire very poorly. But just given the fact that, for example, all of the east of Tripoli is poor working-class industrial area, they are entirely in support of the rebels. In the West, the affluent area, all of whom are Gaddafi's cronies, they are supporting him. So if you're on the side of the working class, for God's sake, you have to support the rebels, don't you?
Well, I think I hear the critique of this war from a segment of our own left in the United States. And I think it doesn't excuse the NATO allies. It doesn't excuse some of the policies that our own government in the past in the United States did it. But I think so far, the dictatorship inside Libya was rejected by the majority of the Libyan people, and we have to respect their choices. It would be really very, very disingenuous to assume that we can talk on behalf of the Libyan people. That's the first thing. The second thing is the jury is still out. Whether this liberation is going to be a true liberation or the country will become a client state or not, whether that's going to be a democratic civil republic or something really giving back to some opportunistic elite, this is, we don't know. For now, we know that this is really a good moment, and Libyan people, with the help of the NATO, yes, they fought very hard for their liberation. And thank God, and I advocated that for a long time, that no troops on the ground, that they fought for 6 months, and Libya seems to be on the verge of being free. Now, what happens after now, there is no a very rosy, clear picture. There is a potential for maybe a model country. There is also potential for becoming really a terrible example. And the revolutions free us to think in all kind of possibilities. This is the crossroads that Libya is in right now. It's a good moment. It was a good war. And the Libyan people are victorious.
Well, of course, history is full of examples of revolutions that bring forth enormous hope, like the Iranian Revolution, arguably the Russian Revolution, and then 20 years ago when Yeltsin came into power and the communists fell, you know, it's eventually been stolen by Putin and the KGB. So it can change, of course, and we all should be aware of it. But I'm just suggesting that we have to have in our political DNA a little bit of respect for humanities and for this universal desire for freedom. And we have to be on the side of...
We need to educate ourselves. I see a lot of bandits, even scholars, reducing Libyan society to tribal identities and regional faces without allowing Libyans to talk for themselves and without thinking about the fact Libyan society, which is the irony of Gaddafi's long government, populist government that became a police state, is Libyan society has one of the highest literacy rates in the region. Also, 80% of the Libyan people live in cities. Libya is now very urbanized, and you're going to see people who really use this cliche and simplistic lenses of tribalism and tribal identities. And I think that's a very misleading way of understanding Libyan society. Libyan society is more than Gaddafi. Libyan society is more than oil. Libyan society is more than also the idea of pre-modern or anti-modern ideas that we've been thinking about since the Iranian Revolution. We are talking about people with faces and voices, and they look very much, their demands are like us. they have universal claims. And that's really crucial if we want to understand why Libyan society is really alienated. And finally, when it gives up on reform, began to really say, you can't reform this regime. We are forced to carry arms, unfortunately. And this is their moment now. Where we go from here, it could be anything. But I think let's not spoil the moment. It's a good war. It was a good uprising made of variety of people, of middle and working class and educated youth. And for that matter, it was a really popular uprising. Let's now hope that this revolution will not be stolen.
Well, I'm optimistic, Ali Abdelatif Hamida, only in as much as we've seen what happened with the young in Egypt. It started out with the students, and then the working class people joined in the revolution, and then the Muslim Brotherhood joined in the revolution.
Yes.
And they're not letting go. They're not trusting the military, and they're still taking to Tahrir Square.
That's right.
And I'm encouraged, for example, in Syria, which I think is similar to Libya. Again, the poorest part of Syria, working class town of Deraa, is where the revolution started. And in the poor neighborhoods of Damascus, this is where the revolution is coming. This is why I can't understand the leftists don't understand that this is actually a left-wing revolution, in the sense that it's the working class against these corrupt elites, these kleptocratic regimes run by families.
Yeah, for a long time, Ian, the Libyan people did not want to march in the street. Actually, the irony in Libya is that had the regime not blowing all the attempts to reform the system in the last 10 years, there would be no revolution in Libya. I think Libyan people were really patient and generous, waiting for real reform about their lives, their schools, their clinics, their future, fighting corruption. You know, having a rule of law, having more freedom of expression and association. And they waited and they waited. And when Gaddafi sent his security forces to shoot on people, people said, you cannot reform this regime. And that's really the reality of it. And right now, I think we see a battle that was forced on the Libyan people because they want to have a peaceful protest. But when the army was sent there, people were found themselves in the corner. And one final note, Ian, I have to comment. I think Muslim or Islamic organization or movement, not all of them of the same type. Some are probably are intolerant and extremist and jihadist. But a lot of our groups and movements, they are not really extremists. And it's very important that as we look at Catholic Church playing roles, Christian activists or groups playing a role, or social democracy in Europe, there are some of these groups who might play a very, very vital role in the political process in the future. And I think it's important not to lump the jihadists, al-Qaeda, all these very, very intolerant groups with every social movement that aspire or inspired by Muslim ideals.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here, Professor Ali Abdelatif.
Thank you, Ian, for having me again. And let's hope that I will talk about Libya a year from now or 2 years, a stable, civil, democratic republic, as we all hope for the Libyan people.
Again, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Professor Ali Abdelatif Hamida, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He is the author of The Making of Modern Libya, Forgotten Voices, Power and Agency in Colonial and Postcolonial Libya, and Post-Orientalism, Critical Reviews in North African Social and Cultural History. Let's take a brief station break now. We'll be back talking about what Libya might look like in a decade from now.
Don't wanna hide behind my front door. Don't.